Hello, Sobertown. Welcome to the Sobertown podcast. Let's jump on that sober train and ride right into the incredible, wonderful world of recovery. And this morning we have an amazing sober warrior, Nancy, and she's going to share her recovery story with us. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Drifter. How are you?
I am doing amazing. How are you?
I am great.
And thank you for being so brave and vulnerable and coming to the Sobertown podcast to share your story. We're very, very grateful.
Well, I appreciate that. I really don't feel like I have an exciting story or something really unique, but I do think I have a common story. And so I feel like it's one that many women in my age probably share and don't really realize necessarily that they have a problem. And it took me a long time to really allow myself to be honest and say, this is becoming a problem in my life. So,
yeah, because most people think unless you're under a bridge or locked up in jail, you don't have a problem, right?
Very true. And I think one of the things that probably slowed me down in my recovery is that I was looking for a group of people to help support myself. And I wandered into the rooms of AA. And there were so many people whose stories were so much worse than mine that I walked out of there sort of thinking, I'm kind of laughable. And didn't really feel like I connected, although I am 100% sure that had I stayed and gotten to know more people in the room, that I would have found people that I could have shared a common story with. I just didn't stick around long enough, and some of the people that would share their stories were the ones who had been really down and out and under the bridge or lost their children or lost their driver's license or were being told to go to AA as part of their recovery. So they really weren't necessarily there willingly. So for that reason, I think in reality, Drifter, I was able to use that as an excuse to not continue. I kind of just sort of saw that I'm not as bad off as a lot of these people in this room. And I'm really just, you only live once and I need to enjoy my life. And I'm making a big deal out of nothing, which is something that I tend to do anyway. And so I eventually left those rooms. And I also had a negative experience with the sponsor because I could not get past the first fucking step on there. I mean, I was working and working and working at the program and trying really hard, which for me, trying hard is really trying hard. And when I met with her at her house the first time, well, that was a whole other experience too, because her dogs, she wasn't there and her dogs attacked me. And yes, and I actually got bitten by her dogs as I had to quickly make my way back to my car to protect myself. And her husband came out and took the dogs in and got them secured so that I wasn't in the way of the dogs. So that's kind of how it all started, my first meeting with her. And then I went in and I had a dog bite on my arm, but I didn't want her to feel bad because this is another negative characteristic I have is don't worry about how you feel. Be more worried about the people around you and hurting their feelings or making them feel uncomfortable. So I'm hiding this wound on my arm. Anyway,
Your addict voice is just screaming, recovery isn't for me.
That, and it's also like the universe is trying to tell me something here. And I left there and I never went back and I started drinking again. First of all, I didn't want to run into her at the meeting that was most convenient. So after that, I really just continued to drink.
Let's get into your story, how you started and go from there.
Okay. Well, I really gave up alcohol this last time. I mean, there have been multiple times when I gave up alcohol, but this last time I started on August 4th, 2022. And it was after the pandemic. And I think the pandemic just did me in with all of the stuff that was going on. And I think that was the case for a lot of people. So basically, I feel like I was a latecomer to the alcohol scene because I really didn't start drinking until I was in my 50s. And part of that was precipitated by a change back into the workforce. I'm a physical therapist by profession, and I had stayed home to take care of my kids, and I had taken a part-time job with the church as a music director, which was a lot of fun. And that just wore me out. And so I morphed my way back into the physical therapy profession. And of course, at this point, I'm in my 50s. And a lot of the people I'm working with are much younger than me. And they're partying after work and having happy hours and all that good stuff. And as I started to get to know people, I wanted to join in the fun. So that's what I did. I went to happy hours and started drinking. And really, truly, before that time, I was super duper healthy. I mean, I was into fitness and cycling and running and all these great things that I was doing. I had a very clean, nutritious diet. At work, my day would start on the 8th floor of the hospital, and I would climb the steps up there. And we were down in the basement, and there were 10 flights of steps. And I was kind of known as the step lady, because that's where I headed to get up to the 8th floor to start my day. So I let go of all of that because I really wanted to be a part of this group of people that I was getting to know at work, and started in on the drinking scene. So that's kind of where it started. And it stayed pretty benign for many, many years, but just slowly started to morph into something a lot more, to the point where I remember going to one of the parties that they had, and I drank like 3 or 4 glasses of wine because I wanted to have that good time that we're so promised. And I actually passed out talking to somebody and basically ended up on the floor of this girl's house, and then throwing up into whatever somebody had available for me. And they had to carry me. Some of my coworkers literally carried me out to the car, and my husband drove us home. And there were a couple of people there that actually took pictures of the whole incident, and they thought it was hilarious. And they had people standing over me doing like a lasso movement and all this stuff. And it was just crazy. But I was ashamed. I laughed it off. So anyway, the other piece to my drinking is that I have suffered with an eating disorder all my life. And that started when I was around 12 or 13. And that's how I actually found AA to begin with, because I started in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. And that's how I got healthy, was I started there and I learned about the 12-step program. And I was very true to that. So that eating disorder was not a problem for me. But when I started working, what I found out in the hospital with people was that if I drank a little bit of alcohol, it completely took away my willpower and I was able to eat to my heart's content. And that was just like, oh my God, such a relief to me. I don't have to think about this anymore. I don't have to worry about my weight. Who cares? That's not a big deal. And it allowed me to then let go of that diet restriction that I had on myself and just enjoy. So now I have not only morphed into an eating disorder, but I now have turned this into two problems instead of one. So as my drinking continued on and on for, let's see, it was probably, 10, 12 years of just more of what I would call occasionally getting too drunk and occasionally getting sick to my stomach, to more or less just being able to tolerate so much alcohol that I was not really experiencing that nausea or that spinning room feeling anymore. And I was just kind of able to drink enough to where I could get a buzz. And the other piece to this that is part of my history is that I have a really strong history for anxiety and depression. And what I never was able to truly wrap my head around was this connection between alcohol and depression. I was really, I think, in denial about that, even though we all know, I mean, my profession is science-based. I'm a healthcare worker. I know that alcohol is a depressant, but I never really truly believed it. And so while I'm drinking this alcohol, I'm also taking antidepressant medication and anti-anxiety medication. And so eventually it got to the point where my anxiety and depression were at the level that my medication dosages were starting to increase. And so I ended up having to go from the 25 milligrams of medication that I was on, morphed into 50, which then morphed into 75 milligrams. And then on top of that, originally I started with some Xanax to go to sleep at night because, of course, we can't sleep as well when we're drinking alcohol. And that morphed into Klonopin, which stays in your system a little bit longer. And I was only taking the Klonopin occasionally because I was scared to get too dependent on the Klonopin because I know it can be very, very addiction related. And so I would basically go to sleep using the alcohol, and then I would wake up in the middle of the night around 2 or 3 in the morning. And then I would take the Klonopin if I just could not fall back asleep. But I would usually wait for a while before I would resort to getting out of bed and just saying, fuck it, I'm taking the Klonopin, and fall back asleep. Anyway, so now I'm drinking, I'm taking Klonopin, I'm occasionally for PRN, for inability to sleep, and I'm taking 75 milligrams of antidepressant. And I'm still really depressed. I mean, I'm just getting more and more despondent, especially after the pandemic happened and my drinking morphed into now an entire bottle of wine every night, which is really not that much to some people. I mean, it's pretty easy over the period of 3 or 4 hours to go through a bottle of wine. You start at 5, you drink a glass, then an hour later, you drink another glass. Maybe an hour later, you've got dinner ready and you drink another glass, and boom, that wine is gone. Then I started slowly hiding it a little bit from my husband because he started noticing a bit of a change in my personality where I would get really grumpy and get really mean towards him. And it started where he would say things like, have you been drinking? And I would be like, I just had one glass. You just don't want to admit that you're annoying to me. I think you have the problem because you're really the annoying one, and you do things that get on my nerves, and it's like I'm not allowed to say anything about it. So that's how I sort of stayed in denial about my husband and his pointing out that this was really resulting in a change in my personality. And I stayed in denial about that for a really long time. This then, all of this started to also encompass my eating. And so my eating habits just became horrible. And it got to the point where my life started with, my day would start with getting up in the morning and I'd eat breakfast and I would vow, okay, today I'm starting fresh. I'm giving up all this alcohol. I'm giving up the overeating. I'm going to get back to my regular routine and be healthy. But by noon, I would be, have talked myself out of it by then. And generally speaking, I was frantic about controlling my weight because my weight was just blossoming. And by the time the pandemic had come along, I was about 50 pounds heavier than I am right now. After the pandemic was over and restaurants started to open up, my husband and I would hop on bikes because we're big cyclists and we each have our own road bike, and we'd do like a 50-mile bike ride, literally. And I'd get home, take a shower, and we'd race up to the Mexican food restaurant, and I'd down 2 margaritas. And then after that, we would go to the Dairy Queen, and I'd get myself either a medium or a large Blizzard. And then after that, I would go home, throw in a movie or a show, and I'd pass out. And I would think I was in hog heaven until I woke up. And then I'd wake up and I'd be beating myself up, maybe having some wine if there was some in the refrigerator to kind of get myself calmed back down, and then eventually fall back into bed. So this became really such a routine, Drifter, that they knew me at the Mexican food restaurant. We were there probably 2 or 3 times a week. And the reason I went to this particular Mexican restaurant was because their margaritas were really strong. And it got to the point where they'd bring them to the table as we seated. They'd bring me my margarita. They knew exactly what I needed or was wanting. So that continued until I eventually just got so disgusted with myself. And I was so depressed. And apparently when I was depressed, I actually spent some time writing in my notepad on my phone, which I didn't remember doing. And until I got to Sobertown and started going to the podcast and started thinking about really giving up the drinking, I didn't find these pieces of writing that I had written. But I want to read to you the one that I wrote before things just got so bad, because I clearly was in a state of despair at this point, but really didn't have much memory of this. And it's not poetic. It's not anything that's going to garner any kind of recognition for writing. It's just sitting down, and really one night I just sat down and wrote my feelings down.
Please do. Please share that.
So this was where I started. Have you ever just felt like a nobody, invisible, desperate, yet completely invisible? Hey, I'm here. God made me, so I must have a purpose, yet no purpose shows themselves. Yes, I had 3 kids. They are all on their own. My eldest needs me and my husband's help while she and her husband navigate careers and 2 kids. And we're there. I'm there. But I need them too. And I need them too much. I can't find any other purpose for living except for them. The emptiness and the sadness, the lack of motivation to seek out new interests or friends. And speaking of friends, I have very few. Actually, I have none. Alone. This one I wrote in May of 2022. And it was August of 2022 that I finally just got to this place where I couldn't.
And you don't remember writing that, do you?
No, I don't. I found it accidentally on my phone. I used my notepad to write grocery lists, and I saw in the folder something titled Nobody. So I'm scrolling through there, and I'm like, what's that? And I read it, and I was like, whoa, when did I write that? And it was May of 2022 when I wrote that.
You're just in despair. You're waking up, like most of us do, with the guilt, shame, remorse, vowing to change. But by noon, you're right back in the same cycle on the hamster wheel.
Yep. And I stayed that way until about August before I reread. I had tried The Naked Mind before, or actually, I think I had read Holly's book, the one not going to be able to remember.
Quit Like a Woman or something like that?
Yes, Quit Like a Woman. I read that book, and I actually had about 4 to 6 months of not drinking, but this was before May of 2022. But then I went right back into the drinking after we had the freeze in McKinney, and that's when I started back again. And that was, I think, in 2021. It was before COVID, so it's, I'm not sure when it was. I can't remember. But for whatever, I went back into the drinking, and it was worse than ever before after that. And it wasn't until August of 2022 that I decided to try and read The Naked Mind to see if some of the science behind the drinking would allow me to wrap my head around this need and some of the facts and the science behind it to stop drinking, kind of using my health as the reason. And it was scaring me a little bit too at that point because my memory was starting to go bad. Like my husband would say, we watched this last night. And I'd be like, what? Or my kids would tell me I said something. And I'd be like, what? I don't remember saying that. I think one time I yelled at my husband and I said something to him and I can't remember what it was, but it was like really mean and nasty. And my son was there. And the next day, both my husband and my son told me what I said. And I had no recollection of that at all, at all. And that started to scare me a little bit. So I read The Naked Mind, and slowly through reading that, I was able to find the website. And I started communicating with some of the people on The Naked Mind, their message board, and kind of writing back and forth. And one day, Fluffy Allspart posted up there some information about Sobertown. And I knew that this loneliness that I had in my life and this lack of purpose, I knew in my heart that I had to address it. And so I went on to the Sobertown Zoom meeting, and one early, early morning, I found one because I'm an early riser that I felt like, okay, when I get up, I'm usually more motivated in the morning. I'm a little bit, drink a cup of coffee, I'm ready to go. I'll be more willing to do something like this and step out of my comfort zone. So I found that early morning one, which was 6 a.m. for me.
On Thursdays, right?
Yes, on Thursday morning. And I hopped on there. And once I did that and started making connections to other people, I began to realize that that was going to have to be part of my program to find my way out. That there was no way that I could do this alone. And that I needed face-to-face connection with people. But I didn't know many people in McKinney because my life as a music director had been over for 18 years. All those people that I met then were long gone or moved on. And all of those friends I had then had moved on. And I really had, I had one close friend that lived in McKinney, or about 30 miles from me. And she and her husband have a farm. And I was able to connect with her, but I didn't have anybody that I was able to connect with on a regular basis and really have a relationship and share this problem with, and be honest and be vulnerable and get a handle on the shame that overtakes all of us. So the Sobertown Zoom thing, the first one, I'm sure Fluffy was there. I can't really remember. I remember Fluffy was there. Neville was there.
Probably James, because James from Poland,
yes,
was running that at that time too, right?
Yes, yes, James. And also, I think either soon thereafter or when I actually started, Mean Joe Blue, who's in Ohio, he was starting up too, because we had similar recovery days in the beginning. So that kind of got me going with making this connection with people. And I told myself I had to do it every Thursday morning. I mean, I just told myself I got to do this. It's got to be part of my recovery, because I had read, I'm pretty sure I had read in The Naked Mind that connection was the opposite of addiction. And then I stumbled on a really good TED talk where a guy from Norway or Switzerland or someplace talks about connection and the rat experiment with the heroin and putting them in a cage where you give a group of rats, I'm sure everybody's heard this, you give one rat heroin in a cage and he just goes, and water, and he goes for the heroin, but you give multiple rats heroin and water and they're much happier and no one goes for the heroin. So I heard that and I really believed it and knew that I had to make these connections. And that's really been a huge part of my journey, and also the hardest part for me is making these connections, because it's very uncomfortable and it requires that I get out of my house, because as a lot of people know, when we drink too much, we isolate. And then, of course, coupled with the weight, I couldn't fit into any of my clothes and I felt ugly and fat and unhealthy and just gross, really, overall, just pretty gross. And so you can just sit inside your house and feel gross and not have to deal with the shame of being out there in the real world. So I started this journey and it's taken me a long time, Drifter. I mean, I've been doing this since August of 2022. And eventually now I'm starting to make more face-to-face connections with people in my community where I live. And I've also taken the time to meet some of the people that I've met on Zoom. I've met Masha. I flew out to meet her when my husband and I went to Spain. I took one day and flew to Germany just to meet Masha and then flew back.
That is so cool that you did that. That is so cool.
And it was so scary because, first of all, I was in Valencia and I don't know Spanish very well at all. I know haltingly Spanish. And I'm by myself and I'm trying to navigate my way through this airport. And it was kind of confusing, but I just kept telling myself that I had to make myself do it. And when that day was over and I got safely back home, I felt like I was walking on top of the world. And it just gave me so much more energy to keep moving forward. Because that's what happens when we get out of our comfort zone. We find that we can do it, and then we're taking the next step forward and doing something else that's a little bit more uncomfortable. The other thing I was doing too is once I stopped drinking, Drifter, I really went back pretty much naturally to my diet of eating healthy fruits, vegetables. I eat a lot of vegetables and fruits. Don't eat red meat, a lot of lean proteins, and cook very clean. And my husband and I don't go out to eat much anymore because I'd much rather eat at home. And so I found myself with the drinking stopped over time. I actually lost 50 pounds.
Wow, that is 50 pounds. Congratulations. That's amazing.
Yeah, I went from over 170 because I got to the point where I was really scared to weigh myself. And now I'm 125 pounds. And I exercise cardiovascularly at least 3 to 4 times a week. That's part of a very important part of my program because I really feel that that helps me relieve my stress and get me my mind in a better place, get a little bit of a dopamine fix going on. And that helps a lot. And if I'm in a bad mood and if it's really bad, like I generally exercise in the morning, but if I'm really feeling yucky and just can't get rid of the feeling, then I will go in the afternoon and hop on my Peloton. I have a Peloton and hop on that for a good 30 minutes. And by the time that's over, I feel like a different person. So exercise is definitely a regular part of my toolkit, and it's specifically cardiovascular exercise. I also started a little bit over a year ago, I started doing a morning daily yoga program, and I do an online yoga program called Find What Feels Good. It's a subscription I pay for, and it's through a lady named Adrienne, who's out of Austin, Texas, and she's known pretty internationally, but I just find I really like her because she's not so intense that I can't handle it, and she kind of works with you where you're at. So I have that going on, and I do that every day religiously. Get up 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and start with a yoga program, and I only do maybe 15 to 20 minutes a day. And then after that, I generally sit down and kind of get my day started. But lately, because I read another book called Miracle Mornings by Hal Elrod, I actually started reading more regularly in the morning. I usually read later in the afternoon. Now I just started reading a little bit in the morning, and I don't read a lot. I have a meditation book that I'm going through that's a Lenten thing because I'm a cradle Catholic who has now morphed into an ecumenical Catholic, and I go to an online church that has a female pastor, and I absolutely love her, and I love the people there, and she's very progressive, and we call ourselves the Catholics that don't exclude anybody because we definitely don't have all these exclusionary things like you, if you're gay, that's sinful. If you're this, you're that. We don't do any of that. Everybody's God's children. God loves everyone equally. And you're all part of this wonderful fabric of the universe and all have a reason to be here. So yeah, I found that also in my recovery. And that's been a big part of it too. I make sure that my husband and I try to get some spiritual input into our lives on a regular basis because that's really important to me.
I do want to ask you, Nancy, in your drinking, you just got worse and worse and you started taking more medication, drinking more, this vicious cycle. As you've gotten sober, where are you at on the medication now?
Oh, thank you so much for asking me that because that was a big part of what I wanted to tell you. But my brain is, have you ever heard about your amygdala getting inflamed?
No.
Your amygdala is your reptilian portion of your brain. And when you're nervous or uneasy or a little bit uncomfortable, it will get inflamed. And then your mind sort of loses its ability to focus.
Oh, that puts you kind of into fight or flight mode, right?
Yes. Yes. And so you just end up just not able to think straight.
I think you're doing amazing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm all over the map, as generally my brain is.
No, you're doing fantastic. And I love that Sobertown has been so instrumental in your recovery. That just, it makes me feel like what we're doing is just worth all of it with you.
Sobertown and the people there are just a staple part of my life. I cannot miss Thursdays. I mean, and I don't look forward to going because I have to get up early. I mean, I have to get up even earlier on Thursday because I got to do my yoga. I got to do my miracle mornings and read, and I got to meditate, and I got to do all this stuff. And then I'm ready for Sobertown at 6. And so it means an early start in the day, but I just don't feel right now if I miss it. And so barring being sick or being in a situation where I'm in a time zone where when we were in Spain, I think I missed Sobertown that morning. But then I'm letting people know, hey, I'm here, people. Because now I'm a little bit afraid that when I miss Sobertown, that somebody's going to think I've fallen off the wagon or something. And so I feel like I got to let people know, all's okay over here. Nancy's still trucking along. And
even before you went to Spain, you were talking about keeping everybody in the Sobertown community in your pocket while you went to Spain because of all the temptations, the flying, and everything that went on with that.
Yes. And that Spain trip was really out of my comfort zone because that was the first time I'd ever gone out of the country in my life. One thing I want to say about the comfort zone thing, and this has been a huge revelation, and I find myself able to really focus on and think about this when I am feeling uncomfortable, and it helps me get back to being okay with what I'm getting ready to do. And that one little piece of information just straightens me out quick. Nancy, I tell myself, you are making this way worse than it's going to be in your head. And it is not going to be this bad. When you actually get in there and do it, this is going to be fine. And you will find the resources that you need to handle it, and it'll all be okay. And now I find myself really able to latch onto that as soon as I mean, this talk is a great example because all week long I've been going, oh, I should just, this is going to be so inconvenient. I'm going to have to go down in the basement. It's going to be cold down there. I'm going to be uncomfortable. I was trying all sorts of things to talk myself. I'm just going to call Drifter and tell him, let's reschedule this. My sister is staying here this week with my daughter, and that's new. They just came in last night. I was trying to find every excuse available. And every time I found myself doing that, I just went straight to, you are making this worse than it is. It'll be fine. You can do it.
You're training yourself to use that technique, aren't you? You've had to apply it and think about it and focus on it to do it, right?
Yes. I have definitely trained myself to do that. In addition to some other things I'm training myself to do after reading the Miracle Mornings and reading, I want to tell you this a little bit. I need to tell you that. Is this okay that I tell you this story?
Sure.
Okay. I'm not taking too long, am I?
You have all the time you want. That's what we do in Sobertown. Okay. There is no time limit.
Okay, good. Here. And you can cut this out, but I need to tell you this. I go to a therapist, kind of PRN, that I've known for many, many years, and I just love her. But one of the things I noticed when I went to Spain is I grew up just being a very fast-moving, fast-paced person. My mom, I have 8 brothers and sisters. You didn't have time to sit around and dilly-dally. Everything my mom did was fast. Everything we did had to be done quickly, get a move on it, If you needed to use the bathroom, there was one bathroom between eight of us that we shared. Get in there, get out, that kind of thing. So it's just part of my nature to speed through everything and really not look at the process, but to look at, okay, I'm going to do this and thank God when I'm done. And when it's over, I'm so relieved. And what I noticed when I went to Spain was before we even left, I said to my husband, I cannot wait till this is in my rearview mirror, because I was so stressed out about this new thing that I was going to do and just worried about it. And I just really wanted to be able to say I had done it. Check it off my list. We go to Spain, and every day our friends that live there, they want to hike every single day. And they are walking so damn slow. I am ready to kill myself. I am just like, oh my God, I can't walk this slow. And I'm saying, and I don't know if you should play this, because if they happen to listen to this podcast, I don't want them to know that this was going through my brain. But I want to tell you this. I just found myself just speeding, like walking ahead of them and then stopping and waiting, not even appreciating really what was around me. Flying to Frankfurt to see Masha was like, oh, I can't wait till this day is over. Everything was about, can't wait till it's over. I can't wait till it's over. And when I got back, I made an appointment to see my therapist. And I said to her, I'm noticing this about myself and it's really bothering me. And I told her, I'm just speeding through my life. And here I am, I'm 65. And all I want to do is just get things over with so I can say I've done it. But I'm not enjoying the process at all. I'm not taking in these moments that now I call them holy moments. These moments that give meaning to our life. I mean, I'm not going to get to the end of my life and say to myself, oh, I wish I would have hiked 10 more miles and gone faster on that hike. What I'm going to say to myself is, I wish I would have spent more time with my friends and enjoyed their company more and developed that relationship more and shared more of my vulnerability with them. I'm not going to miss how many miles I hiked. I'm just not. I don't think that's what we're going to wish for. Or we're not going to wish for that we'd worked more hours, any of that. So I started to recognize that. And I said this to my therapist. And she said immediately to me, you have got to hear this song. And she played for me this wonderful song. And I'm going to tell you the name of it. And you're going to have to Google it and listen to it afterwards, because it's just, it was so perfect. And it's called the Deathbed Song. And it's by a woman. Her name is Kirtana, K-I-R-T-A-N-A. And the lyrics to the song, I've got to pull this up real quick. May I do that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I want to hear the song now too, because I find myself rushing through life too. So what you're saying right now is impacting me too. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And I mean, partly because I'm a lot older than you.
No, you're not.
I feel like I am.
I will be 61 in May.
Oh, well, then you definitely need to hear this song.
Yeah, because I rush through life with work, getting home, doing honeydews. I definitely need to take more time to appreciate what's going on around me.
I'm sending it to you now, but I'll just read you some lyrics. If I had the chance to live life over, I would go more slowly. That's for sure. I wouldn't put up such a fight to have my way or prove I'm right or overlay the world with my agenda. I would open each day like a present, tender toward whatever came my way. Every texture, joy or pain, searing sun or healing rain. for I have seen the masks of my beloved. And when she writes this mask of my beloved, it's the masks. I'm the beloved. And it's the masks that we all wear in our life as we go out into the world. I would not be so restless, so eager to mess with the nectar of what is, that I miss, that I overthink the kiss. No, actually, she changes the words in the song. She says that I miss the sacred kiss or turn my mouth away. I would not take a single breath for granted, and I would spend much more time on my knees. For once you've strewn the ashes up, the bodies of the ones you love, you learn something about what really matters. And I know that love is worth the wounding and that the dance is too brief to sit through. So even though my heart would break, what a deep, exquisite ache. Isn't that just the language? Aren't those aches truly exquisite, painful, but just so intense? I would always be a fool for love. So she let me hear that in her office, and I just started crying right away. And since that moment, I have started to tell myself, and I started meditating in the morning on, I call them the four C's. And I do standing balances in the morning just to practice my balance because I don't want to fall and break my hip. And I meditate on four things: calm, because I need to go more slowly through my day, take breaths and calm down. Commitment, because I need to follow through with what I say I'm going to do. Like, don't back out on you, Drifter. Courage, because I need courage to step out of my comfort zone. It's so hard. And connection. I need connection to other people in order to stay on this path of sobriety. So my mornings kind of start that way with some yoga. Then I meditate on those four things. And sometimes they morph into other things. Sometimes I do my fingers like this and say, peace begins with me. Because I recognize that the way that we take ourselves out into the world is how the world sees us. And it also impacts the world. So if I go out and I'm grumpy to a cashier at the grocery store, or I honk my horn at somebody because I would need them to get out of my way, is that person now going to be grumpy towards whoever, the next person that crosses their path when they do something that might be a little irritating? It's amazing how people are so much more drawn to you when you're smiling, when you're happy, when you're energetic. So I try to really take myself out into the world that way, and I focus on it. I mean, that is really something that I have become more mindful about. And I want to say this too, because I'm 582 days into recovery. These last little bits that I'm talking about in my recovery, they just started happening. I mean, I think it's really easy for us early on to get really frustrated that the change is coming so slow. I know I did. It was like, when am I supposed to feel more motivated? When am I supposed to start feeling like, oh, I want to tackle something new, or I want to go out and just wrestle the world? And I've realized, my gosh, this is a process. What helped me say that to myself is the fact that other people on Zoom meetings were telling me, the people that were further ahead of me were telling me, this is going to happen if you stick with it. It's a process. And just taking that little bit of a nugget when I'd start to get impatient or feel like I just wanted to throw in the towel, it was like, nope, inch by inch.
Everything that you're doing is intentional. You're doing it on purpose. they're on purpose and intentional, but it takes time to rewire the brain to build these new synapses, and it takes a while. So let's get back to your medication.
That's where I was going next. So I'm now basically on 25, back down to 25 milligrams. I no longer take any anti-anxiety medications. Those are out of my life. I don't even have any in my cabinet. I do have a non-addictive substance that they give me, that they gave me. I think it's called hydroxyzine. It's very mild. And when I flew on the plane, I took it to help me relax a little bit to go to sleep. And I have plenty in my cabinet, but I never really take it. I never take it. It's just there. I used to bring all this stuff with me on trips. I don't need it anymore. I don't need to, because I just don't think about it. So I'm down to 25. I tried weaning off the 25 last summer. And that was during the time in Texas when we had those string of 107, 110 heat wave days. And I just found myself so anxious about watching this unfold and being stuck in Texas and wanting to get out of Texas that I tried weaning off, but ended up having to go back on. But I'm going to try again because I have new tools in my toolkit that I've developed since that time. And I'm hoping that those will help me be able to be more successful. And I want to say this too. In getting off my medication, I did it under the advice of my psychiatrist. I did not just throw the medication away. I let her know, and she guided me through the weaning process. So I was not just out there on my own doing this. And so I'm going to try again at some point. I don't know when. We'll see. I think I'll know when I'm ready. And if it doesn't work, I'm okay with that too. That's fine.
So let's talk about your mornings. In your addiction, you woke up determined not to do this anymore, full of guilt, shame, remorse, all of that. Waking up depressed. How are you waking up now?
Well, still kind of making myself get out of bed. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to say that it's easy to make myself get up. But I also know that you have to do it. And I have enough success strung along that it motivates me to say, here's where I'm headed. And I know that this is the part that I got to do to get there. And so I'm able to get up. Once I'm up and put those clothes on, I'm out. I'm just in automatic, rolling out my mat and putting on my videos and getting with it. By the time I get through the yoga and start the meditation piece, I am feeling much calmer, much more present, much more in tune with my day. And by the time I get done with the meditation, I'm just like ready to go. Let's go. Let's get this done. Now I have added some reading, and also I started just doing a little bit of writing. Not much. I did a lot of journaling in my past. I think it's very valuable and I want to do more, but right now my morning already takes so much time that I just feel like, you know, you don't want to get to this point where you stack so much stuff in there that then you just throw in the towel and quit doing it.
So when you wake up in the morning, you don't go through any of that guilt, shame, and remorse anymore, right?
No, there's none of that. It's relief.
Oh, so you wake up in the mornings relieved.
Yes. Especially in the beginning when this was new, it was just like, oh, thank God, I didn't either drink or overeat. Both of those. I wake up just feeling those. As a matter of fact, to be honest with you, I don't even think about it anymore. It's just, I just get up and get going and just happy to see what's happening and what's going to happen. And by the time I have my first cup of coffee, oh, shit, I am lit, man. I'm just like, my husband's like, okay, reel it in, darling. Reel it in.
So let's talk about the other part of this equation, your marriage.
That's better. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, as a matter of fact, and I didn't mention this, my husband was drinking some beer, but he wasn't a big drinker. But because I was drinking, he was drinking. And so I kind of got him drinking more. And when I stopped, he stopped. And he hasn't had any alcohol either since I stopped. And he's not a problem drinker. He didn't use it to numb. He would be after a bike. There's nothing better than a beer after a long bike ride. I'm just going to tell you, I still miss that a little bit, but he would always enjoy a beer after a bike ride. But no, he just doesn't anymore because it's so important to him because his life is so much better now with me not drinking. And my relationship with my kids is much better. My oldest daughter and I have a little kind of relationship going, and she used to be the one that would, if I would be naggy at her, she would say, "Are you drinking? Have you been drinking?" And which sometimes I had, but sometimes I hadn't. But I think just in general, my whole personality was much more negative then. And she has had some bouts where she quits drinking as well. And as a matter of fact, her and her husband are both drinking a lot less since I've stopped drinking. It's just no longer part of our social setting anymore. Who's going to bring the alcohol and how much are we going to have there? Or let me make some more. That's just not part of it. It's not the main focus anymore of any of our gatherings. So I think in general, my whole family we're all much happier. And I think also, I know my middle daughter, that's who I'm at her house right now. And she is doing a fellowship in cardiothoracic surgery. And she has been so, so quick to say to me, "Mom, I'm so proud of you. I'm just so proud of what you're doing." My oldest daughter, when I told her I was going to quit, her first response was, "Again?" And it pissed me off. Oh my God, it pissed me off. And it made me really question my ability to do it. There's nothing worse than having a bunch of people around who've seen you fail remind you that you failed whenever you try again, which is so important for all of us to do, is to keep trying, you know?
Don't give up.
Don't give up. Don't give up. Yeah. So, but my relationship with my husband is so much happier now. And this mindfulness stuff has helped too, because I can be kind of short sometimes with him because I'm still automatically fall into that fast movement pace. And so to tell myself, I have to just mindfully tell myself, don't spit out the first answer. And I'm finding myself being able to actually do that in my brain before he asks me a question, which in my heart I might think is a really dumb question because I've already given him the answer to that like 50 times. And so my first response would be like, "I told you that already," or it would be a grumpy restatement of the answer to that question. Now I'm finding myself, and this has really just happened in the last few months, where I'm able to actually roadblock that and take a little bit of a breath and come out with something pleasant to say.
And this comes down that you're consciously being aware of what you're doing. You've been practicing at this. It didn't just happen overnight. You've been practicing it. And now you're starting to see some of the fruits of your labor.
Definitely.
That's exciting.
Well, it is so exciting because I think a lot of us think we get to a certain age and we can't change. And I think we really have to get rid of that belief because we can't. And I feel like really I'm changing. So I'm kind of thinking in myself, who knows where I'm going to be 5 years from now? I used to have this dream that I wanted to do something that would be so notable that Oprah Winfrey would call me up, invite me on her show. I have an older brother that I'm very close to, and he lives in Washington, D.C., and he's a therapist. And so he's been on this journey with me, and he's always teasing me about that. And he'll say to me, well, you may not get on there, but maybe one of your kids will, and then you can go on vicariously. But
well, you let him know that you made it to Sobertown.
He already knows about this. And I want to tell you, he's asked me multiple times for the information regarding Sobertown to pass on to clients, because he's told me the other day, because I told him that I was going to do this, and I said, my story is not very exciting. It's pretty boring. And he said, Nancy, you wouldn't believe the number of people that I have. He's in his 70s. So, and his clientele is older as well, that I have in my practice, women especially, that are dealing with this issue, the same issue you're dealing with, and how hard it is for him to convince them that the alcohol is playing a part of some of the issues that they're struggling with in terms of anxiety and depression. But he passes on Sobertown information to them all the time if he has an opportunity.
And it's not about how deep our bottoms are, jails, prisons, or whatever. Alcohol addiction still brings us all to that same place where we hate who we are. This isn't who we want to be. We wake up with the guilt, shame, and remorse. It takes us all to that place. And recovery, it just changes us on the inside to where we don't have to be like that anymore. There's something else that I think is really cool that you mentioned here, and that's that there are parts in your life where you miss having a beer, like after a bike ride. But you're consciously aware of that if you do take that beer, the consequences of drinking that beer. And I think it's really cool that you're able to acknowledge that there are times in your life where you enjoy drinking.
Oh, definitely. And I think the big lesson where I really kind of was able to wrap my head around believing that one drink could lead me back where I started from and worse is when I read William Porter's Alcohol Explained book. And also Dr. Anna Lemke out of Stanford has a great explanation of what alcohol does to your brain. And it basically convinced me that once you cross the line of using alcohol or any substance to numb feelings, you've crossed over and you can't go back. I never was there for the taste. I don't even like alcohol. I hated beer. Oh my God, I thought it was disgusting until I learned to drink it. But once you cross over, and that's really what I know now, and I know this in my heart, that if I ever cross over, that I'm never going to be able to moderate. And I feel badly when I see people trying to moderate who crossed over, because what happens is that they have to think about it so much more now. Alcohol, how much they're going to have. Oh, I got to stop here. And once you're in that, that's the opposite of being able to moderate. Moderate is the person who has a little sip and doesn't set it down and doesn't think about whether they finish the glass or not. So I think finally I'm a believer. And it took a long time, but I am a believer that there's no going back for me. There's no question in my mind about that for myself. And I would never want to tell somebody else how to do this, because you really have to come to this place where you're ready to do it for yourself.
And kind of find what works, because even with all of your history with the steps from your eating disorder on and on, that wasn't working and you had to find something that worked for you.
Yeah.
And you finally have. And that's what we're hoping to do at Sobertown is just put everything out there. Here's the steps. Here's this. Dharma Recovery, whatever's out there. And then you build your own recovery program that works for you specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I tell everybody I can about Sobertown now because I just think that it's a wonderful resource and tool that's not AA for those people where AA may not have worked for whatever reason. And at this point, Drifter, I would totally walk back into the rooms of AA and enjoy going to a meeting. As a matter of fact, I think about it sometimes. I would be able to do that now, but I could not have started there.
Yeah, because you can walk into a meeting now and you get it.
Yes.
You get it. And you're not looking at all the differences. You're looking at more what you have in common.
Yeah.
Because you've been able to like slowly build these awarenesses. You have clarity.
Yeah. And one other thing I want to make sure I mention to you that I think is so important for people to realize is that one of the things that helped me so much in the recovery part was seeing people who were further along in the journey and having those people hold on to my hope for me until I was able to have hope for myself. So now I see myself when I go to those meetings, I'm not just there for me. I'm holding on to hope for anybody who's not as far along to help them have that hope to get to this place where so many people are finding some freedom and relief from the anxiety, the depression, because it feels so hopeless. So to have people out there talking about this and giving you hope in the early days, man, is just like, and I just hung on to that for dear life, truly. Just kept thinking that if I just keep putting one foot in front of the other, I will someday be where that person is.
And you've even hosted a couple Zooms since then too, haven't you?
Yeah, that's not my favorite thing to do, but I will do it because it makes me uncomfortable and recognize it. And to be honest, my husband and I regularly host Zoom for all the people that go to my church via Zoom. I mean, it's an actual physical building in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, but there's also people on Zoom. And we do Zoom hosting regularly for those people coming on for that. It's not like this because we don't have to do much but just spotlight people or whatever, but and let people in and all that good stuff. But still, we do get our share of Zoom hosting in. I feel like I get my share in doing that because there's not a lot of people who want to do it.
Well, we're very grateful when you have stepped in. So thank you very much.
And I'm so grateful to the people who do it very regularly. I mean, really, I don't know that they know how important they are or hear how important they are or get thanked a lot, but I sure am grateful because I would have not found this if somebody hadn't been willing to host it.
And that's what's so cool about recovery is when people get sober, they want to give back what they're learning and what they're experiencing. So we have people further ahead, they're reaching back in the trenches to help pull those people out of the trenches. Yep. And then they get moving along and they want to reach back and help those behind them. It's really exciting. Nancy, thank you so much for coming on here and sharing your journey with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for letting me do this, Drifter. I really appreciate it.
And if anybody wants to get to know you, they could go on Thursdays, 6 a.m. Eastern time, or it's 7 a.m. Eastern time, actually.
It's 7 a.m. Eastern and 6 a.m. Central.
Mm-hmm. Right. 7 a.m. Eastern time to Sobertown Zooms. So,
that's right.
Boom.
That's where I'll be.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.